Chapter 130. Rain, the above everyday events had occurred, and a few weeks had passed, when on one fine morning, Parliament being over, the summer advanced, and all the good company in London about to quit that city for their annual tour in search of pleasure or health, the Badavere steamboat left the tower stairs laden with a goodly company of English fugitives. The quarter-deck awnings were up, and the benches and gangways crowded with scores of rosy children, bustling nursemaids, ladies in the prettiest pink bonnets and summer dresses, gentlemen in traveling caps and linen jackets, whose mustachios had just begun to sprout for the ensuing tour, and stout trim old veterans with starched neckcloths and neat brushed hats, such as have invaded Europe any time since the conclusion of the war, and carry the national goddamn into every city of the continent. The congregation of hat boxes, and drama desks, and dressing cases was prodigious. There were jaunty young Cambridge men traveling with their tutor, and going for a reading excursion to Nonnenwerth or Knickswinter. There were Irish gentlemen, with the most dashing whiskers and jewelry, talking about horses incessantly, and prodigiously polite to the young ladies on board, whom, on the contrary, the Cambridge lads and their pale-faced tutor avoided with maiden coyness. There were old Pall Mall loungers bound for Ems and Wiesbaden and a course of waters, to clear off the dinners of the season, and a little roulette and trente quarante to keep the excitement going. There was old Methuselah, who had married his young wife, with Captain Papillon of the Guards holding her parasol and guidebooks. There was young May, who was carrying off his bride on a pleasure tour, Mrs. Winter that was, and who had been at school with May's grandmother. There was Sir John and my lady with a dozen children, and corresponding nursemaids, and the great grandee Barrister's family, that sat by themselves near the wheel, stared at everybody, and spoke to no one. Their carriages, emblazoned with coronets and heaped with shining imperials, were on the foredeck, locked in with a dozen more such vehicles. It was difficult to pass in and out amongst them, and the poor inmates of the fore cabin had scarcely any space for locomotion. These consisted of a few magnificently attired gentlemen from Houndsditch, who brought their own provisions, and could have bought half the gay people in the grand saloon, a few honest fellows with mustachios and portfolios, who set to sketching, before they had been half an hour on board, one or two French femmes de chamber who began to be dreadfully ill by the time the boat had passed Greenwich, a groom or two who lounged in the neighborhood of the horse boxes under their charge, or leaned over the side by the paddle wheels, and talked about who was good for the leisure, and what they stood to win or lose for the Goodwood Cup. All the couriers, when they had done plunging about the ship, and had settled their various masters in the cabins, or on the deck, congregated together and began to chatter and smoke, the Hebrew gentleman joining them, and looking at the carriages. There was Sir John's great carriage, that would hold 13 people, my Lord Methuselah's carriage, my Lord Barrister's chariot, britska, and Fergan, that anybody might pay for who liked. It was a wonder how my lord got the ready money to pay for the expenses of the journey. The Hebrew gentleman knew how he got it. They knew what money his lordship had in his pocket at that instant, and what interest he paid for it, and who gave it him. Finally, there was a very neat handsome traveling carriage, about which the gentleman speculated. A coup I set voiture là? Said one gentleman courier with a large Morocco money bag and earrings to another with earrings, and a large Morocco money bag. Keste kirsch g bens g la I voot out a lure kui brenoit de sandwiches dans la voiture, said the courier in a fine German French. Kirsch emerging presently from the neighborhood of the hold, where he had been bellowing instructions intermingled with polyglot oaths to the ship's men engaged in secreting the passengers' luggage, came to give an account of himself to his brother interpreters. He informed them that the carriage belonged to a nabob from Calcutta and Jamaica, enormously rich, and with whom he was engaged to travel, And at this moment a young gentleman who had been warned off the bridge between the paddle boxes, and who had dropped thence onto the roof of Lord Methuselah's carriage, from which he made his way over other carriages and imperials until he had clambered onto his own, descended thence and through the window into the body of the carriage, to the applause of the couriers looking on. Nous allons avoir une belle traversée, Monsieur George, said the courier with a grin, as he lifted his gold-laced cap. Dear French, said the young gentleman, where's the biscuits, eh? Whereupon Kirsch answered him in the English language or in such an imitation of it as he could command for, though he was familiar with all languages, Mr. Kirsch was not acquainted with a single one, and spoke all with indifferent volubility and incorrectness. The imperious young gentleman who gobbled the biscuits, and indeed it was time to refresh himself, for he had breakfasted at Richmond full 3 hours before, was our young friend George Osborne. Uncle Joe's and his mama were on the quarter deck with a gentleman, of whom they used to see a good deal, and the four were about to make a summer tour. Joe's was seated at that moment on deck under the awning, and pretty nearly opposite to the Earl of Barrister's and his family, whose proceedings absorbed the Bengalee almost entirely. Both the noble couple looked rather younger than in the eventful year 15, when Joe's remembered to have seen them at Brussels. Indeed, he always gave out in India that he was intimately acquainted with them. Lady Barrister's hair, which was then dark, was now a beautiful golden auburn, whereas Lord Barrister's whiskers, formerly red, were at present of a rich black with purple and green reflections in the light. But changed as they were, the movements of the noble pair occupied Joe's mind entirely. The presence of a lord fascinated him, and he could look at nothing else. Those people seem to interest you a good deal, said Dobbin, laughing, and watching him. Amelia too laughed. She was in a straw bonnet with black ribbons, and otherwise dressed in mourning, but the little bustle and holiday of the journey pleased and excited her, and she looked particularly happy. What a heavenly day! Emmy said and added, with great originality, I hope we shall have a calm passage. Joe's waved his hand, scornfully glancing at the same time under his eyelids at the great folks opposite. If you had made the voyages we have, he said, you wouldn't much care about the weather. But nevertheless, traveler as he passed the night direfully sick in his carriage, where his courier tended him with brandy and water and every luxury. In due time this happy party landed at the quays of Rotterdam, whence they were transported by another steamer to the city of Cologne. Here the carriage and the family took to the shore, and Joe's was not a little gratified to see his arrival announced in the Cologne newspapers as Herr Graf Lord von Sedley nebst begleiting aus London. He had his court dress with him. He had insisted that Dobbin should bring his regimental paraphernalia. He announced that it was his intention to be presented at some foreign courts, and pay his respects to the sovereigns of the countries which he honored with a visit. Wherever the party stopped, and an opportunity was offered, Mr. Joe's left his own card, and the Major's upon her minister. It was with great difficulty that he could be restrained from putting on his cocked hat and tights to wait upon the English consul at the free city of Judenstadt, when that hospitable functionary asked our travelers to dinner. He kept a journal of his voyage, and noted elaborately the defects or excellences of the various inns at which he put up, and of the wines and dishes of which he partook. As for Emmy, she was very happy and pleased. Dobbin used to carry about for her her stool and sketchbook, and admired the drawings of the good-natured little artist as they never had been admired before. She sat upon steamers' decks, and drew crags and castles, or she mounted upon donkeys and ascended to ancient robber towers, attended by her two aides-de-camp, Georgie, and Dobbin. She laughed, and the Major did too, at his droll figure on donkey back, with his long legs touching the ground. He was the interpreter for the party, having a good military knowledge of the German language, and he and the delighted George fought the campaigns of the Rhine and the Palatinate. In the course of a few weeks, and by assiduously conversing with Herr Kirsch on the box of the carriage, Georgi made prodigious advance in the knowledge of High Dutch, and could talk to hotel waiters and postilions in a way that charmed his mother and amused his guardian. Mr. Joes did not much engage in the afternoon excursions of his fellow travelers. He slept a good deal after dinner, or basked in the arbors of the Pleasant Inn Gardens. Pleasant Rhine Gardens. Fair scenes of peace and sunshine, noble purple mountains, whose crests are reflected in the magnificent stream. Who has ever seen you that is not a grateful memory of those scenes of friendly repose and beauty? To lay down the pen, and even to think of that beautiful Rhineland makes one happy. At this time of summer evening, the cows are trooping down from the hills, lowing and with their bells tinkling, to the old town, with its old moats, and gates, and spires, and chestnut trees, with long blue shadows stretching over the grass, the sky and the river below flame in crimson and gold, and the moon is already out, looking pale towards the sunset. The sun sinks behind the great castle-crested mountains, the night falls suddenly, the river grows darker and darker, lights quiver in it from the windows, in the old ramparts, and twinkle peacefully in the villages under the hills on the opposite shore. So Joes used to go to sleep a good deal with his bandana over his face, and be very comfortable, and read all the English news, and every word of Galignani's admirable newspaper. May the blessings of all Englishmen who have ever been abroad rest on the founders and proprietors of that piratical print. And whether he woke or slept, his friends did not very much miss him. Yes, they were very happy. They went to the opera often of evenings, to those snug, unassuming, dear old operas in the German towns, where the noblesse sits and cries, and knits stockings on the one side, over against the bourgeoisie on the other, and his transparency the Duke and his transparent family, all very fat and good-natured, come and occupy the great box in the middle, and the pit is full of the most elegant slim-waisted officers with straw-colored mustachios, and twopence a day on full pay. Here it was that Emmy found her delight, and was introduced for the first time to the wonders of Mozart and Cimarosa. The major's musical taste has been before alluded to, and his performances on the flute commended. But perhaps the chief pleasure he had in these operas was in watching Emmy's rapture while listening to them. A new world of love and beauty broke upon her when she was introduced to those divine compositions. This lady had the keenest and finest sensibility, and how could she be indifferent when she heard Mozart? The tender parts of An Juan awakened in her rapture so exquisite, that she would ask herself, when she went to say her prayers of a night, whether it was not wicked to feel so much delight as that with which Edra Icarino and Adi Batty filled her gentle little bosom. But the major, whom she consulted upon this head, as her theological adviser and who himself had a pious and reverent soul, said that for his part, every beauty of ardor nature made him thankful as well as happy, and that the pleasure to be had in listening to fine music, as in looking at the stars in the sky, or at a beautiful landscape or picture, was a benefit for which we might thank heaven as sincerely as for any other worldly blessing. And in reply to some faint objections of Mrs. Amelia's, taken from certain theological works like The Washerwoman of Finchley Common, and others of that school, with which Mrs. Osborne had been furnished during her life at Brompton, he told her an Eastern fable of the owl who thought that the sunshine was unbearable for the eyes, and that the nightingale was a most overrated bird. "He is one's nature to sing, and the other's to hoot," he said, laughing, "and with such a sweet voice as you have yourself, you must belong to the bulbul faction." I like to dwell upon this period of her life, and to think that she was cheerful and happy. You see, as he has not had too much of that sort of existence as yet, and has not fallen in the way of means to educate her tastes or her intelligence. As he has been domineered over hitherto by vulgar intellects. It is the lot of many a woman. And as every one of the dear sex is the rival of the rest of her kind, timidity passes for folly in their charitable judgments, and gentleness for dullness, and silence which is but timid denial of the unwelcome assertion of ruling folks, and tacit Protestantism above all, finds no mercy at the hands of the female Inquisition. Thus, my dear and civilized reader, if you and I were to find ourselves this evening in a society of greengrocers, let us say, it is probable that our conversation would not be brilliant. If, on the other hand, a greengrocer should find himself at a refined and polite tea table, where everybody was saying witty things, and everybody of fashion and repute tearing her friends to pieces, in the most delightful manner, it is possible that the stranger would not be very talkative, and by no means interesting or interested. And it must be remembered that this poor lady had never met a gentleman in her life until this present moment. Perhaps these are rarer personages than some of us think for. Which of us can point out many such in his circle, men whose aims are generous, whose truth is constant, and not only constant in its kind, but elevated in its degree, whose want of meanness makes them simple, who can look the world honestly in the face with an equal manly sympathy for the great and the small. We all know 100 whose coats are very well made, and 80 who have excellent manners, and 1 or 2 happy beings who are what they call in the inner circles, and have shot into the very center and bullseye of the fashion. But of gentlemen how many? Let us take a little scrap of paper, and each make out his list. My friend the major I write, without any doubt, in mine. He had very long legs, a yellow face, and a slight lisp, which at first was rather ridiculous. But his thoughts were just, his brains were fairly good, his life was honest and pure, and his heart warm and humble. He certainly had very large hands and feet, which the 2 George Osbornes used to caricature and laugh at, and their jeers and laughter perhaps led poor little Emmy astray as to his worth. But have we not all been misled about our heroes, and changed our opinions 100 times? Emmy, in this happy time, found that hers underwent a very great change in respect of the merits of the major. Perhaps it was the happiest time of both their lives, indeed, if they did, but know it and who does? Which of us can point out, and say that was the culmination, that was the summit of human joy? But at all events, this couple were very decently contented, and enjoyed as pleasant a summer tour as any pair that left England that year. Georgie was always present at the play, but it was the major who put Emmy's shawl on after the entertainment, and in the walks and excursions the young lad would be on the head, and up a tower stair or a tree, whilst the soberer couple were below, the major smoking his cigar with great placidity and constancy, whilst Emmy sketched the site or the ruin. It was on this very tour that I, the present writer of a history, of which every word is true, had the pleasure to see them first, and to make their acquaintance. It was at the little comfortable ducal town of Pumpernickel, that very place where Sir Pitt Crawley had been so distinguished as an attaché, but that was in early days, and before the news of the Battle of Austerlitz sent all the English diplomatists in Germany to the right about, that I first saw Colonel Dobbin and his party. They had arrived with the carriage and courier at the Erbrunn's Hotel, the best of the town, and the whole party dined at the table d'hôte. Everybody remarked the majesty of Joe's, and the knowing way in which he sipped, or rather sucked, the Johannesburger, which he ordered for dinner. The little boy too, we observed, had a famous appetite, and consumed schinken, and braten, and kartoffeln, and cranberry jam, and salad, and pudding, and roast fowls, and sweetmeats, with a gallantry that did honor to his nation. After about 15 dishes, he concluded the repast with dessert, some of which he even carried out of doors, for some young gentlemen at table, amused with his coolness and gallantry. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.